Hi, you're listening to The Playlist. I'm Fiona Williams, and coming up on today's show, we're talking to Benjamin Law about mining his family history for Family Law. And given the news of Daniel Day-Lewis's plans to retire, we're going to be talking about other times that great actors have decided that it's time to call it quits. This is The Playlist, and I'm joined by Nick Bessine.
Daniel Day-Lewis, he's retiring from the movies after Phantom Thread.
Yeah, it's coming out at the end of the year.
It's his latest collaboration with Paul Thomas Anderson, and then he's going to be hanging it up. I guess it's sad for a lot of people, but he's not that prolific. He only comes out with a movie every few years.
And he famously semi-retired, well, maybe it was planned to be permanent. Right. In the 90s, he went away and apparently was a cobbler until a friend of the show, Martin Scorsese, tapped him for Gangs of New York and convinced him to come back.
Still looking for that line of shoes, that DDL line of shoes.
Well, maybe this is going to be the start of something big.
For me, Daniel Day-Lewis is all about the big, big over-the-top roles, like Gangs of New York, Last of the Mohicans, Stay Alive, No Matter What Occurs, I Will Find You. It's a favorite.
Maybe he delivered it a little differently.
Stay Alive, No Matter What Occurs, I Will Find You.
That's good.
A little bit better.
That's better. And There Will Be Blood.
Yes, great in that. Drinking everybody's milkshake.
But I like him in the supporting role in A Room with a View. That's always, I love that movie, but he's particularly funny. It's one of his comic turns in that he's sort of the dweeby.
Is he funny
suitor.
In anything else? He's good in Age of Innocence, which is the suitor, also a suitor role.
Yeah, and his suitor phase. On this, we were thinking, you know, he didn't actually announce it. He didn't. He's not the kind of guy who'd hold a press conference.
No.
I think Variety got wind of it, so they had his reps confirm it. So, it, you know. But it got us to thinking, is it good to know going, you know, his film hasn't come out yet. It's at the end of the year. So, you know, we're going to know this one is going to be it. So do you like to know in advance? Because sometimes the greats do a film and then afterwards they think, yeah, I'm out. And maybe it's not their best work.
Well, I think of it more in terms of what Michael Caine says about it, where he said that you don't retire from the movies retire you. You stop getting those calls. Mm. And while Daniel Day-Lewis isn't that kind of actor where he's sitting by the phone waiting to be in whatever.
Yeah, he collaborates more with some of the same people all the time.
I think of it more as an actor does all of his body of work, and then suddenly I look up and I'm asking, is that person dead?
Because you haven't seen them in
because
a while.
I haven't seen them in a long time, and whatever happened to that person?
Right,
is
right. So like a Gene Hackman who
I don't
has
know
been
if,
absent for a long time.
Is Gene Hackman
still with
alive?
Us?
Oh, okay.
At the time of recording.
Great.
But he's not done anything since Welcome to Mooseport.
Right. A lot of us haven't done anything since Welcome to Mooseport.
It's a
Ray Romano vehicle.
It is a Ray Romano vehicle. And Sean Connery.
Yeah.
His last one was that god-awful.
Is he still with us?
Yes, at the time of recording.
Okay.
His last one was A League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
Yeah, that wasn't great. I think before it happened, you could have had high hopes for that because it was a popular graphic novel. That,
sure.
And that Alan Moore guy, his movies are fun.
Yeah, but after you saw it.
No, it wasn't that fun.
And Jack Nicholson, he hasn't done a...
Yes.
He's at basketball games mainly, I think, but he is apparently attached to the English language remake of Tony Erdmann, so... You know, got that to look at.
So when somebody retires, when an actor retires, what happens to them? Where does he go? What pasture are they put out to?
Well, I mean, there is a famous retirement village in Hollywood that was founded, you know, to look after actors once they're not working anymore. It's certainly, you know, when they're reaching the later stages. It relies on benefactors and is supported by AMPUS and whatnot. But come Oscar time, that's one of the hottest places around because they're all still eligible to vote.
Does your eligibility, it doesn't run out, it doesn't expire, it just keeps going?
Well, that has been cited as one of the problems in that some of the Oscar movies, why that phrase is around because they go for the safer films because the argument has been that it's quote-unquote oldies in the retirement village that are making the key choices. And certainly prior to the recent changes to the voting guidelines, this retirement village, Leo DiCaprio famously worked around there when he was doing The Aviator. They have screenings at the retirement home and whatnot. Oh. Yeah, it didn't work out for Leo that time. But yeah, it's
nice that they, because you think of Hollywood spitting people out.
Yeah.
So it's nice that there's a place for, These are all very old people.
Well, yeah, we're talking 90s. Yeah, we're not talking there. Daniel Day-Lewis is not moving in, but it's
Annabelle Ciora is not over there.
Who? Sorry, I didn't hear.
Annabelle Ciora.
No, not that I know of. Not at the time of recording. But no, it is lovely. You know, they can all, a lot of the contemporaries in the home together. And I think people like George Clooney and Jeffrey Katzenberg and whatnot, it's Jodie Foster, it's struggled at times to keep its funding. Afloat. Yeah, exactly. Oh, right. So now it relies on the benefactors and organisations to ensure that they look after their own.
Great.
Mm. In the meantime, we can catch Phantom Thread. It's due for a December release this year. So I'm excited. More so now that I know it may well be his last.
Yeah, I'll definitely watch it. He'll definitely be something to see. Although the last couple of Paul Thomas Anderson movies, I wasn't that into. The Master and Inherent Vice.
Yeah, I like The Master though.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is great, but it was just long and slow.
Okay.
For me.
Daniel Day-Lewis may get his fourth Oscar for it.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows? He's famously won three, but he may go out and high with the fourth one.
Shifting gears a little bit, we've got on SBS, The Family Law.
Series two.
And we've got a great chat coming up with Benjamin Law. Producer Dan and I talked to him about the new series of his show and TV diversity. Well, Ben.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks.
On the playlist. So the second season of Family Law, can you talk a little bit about how this second series is different to the first?
Yeah. Well, in some ways, Nick, it's kind of like a very seamless transition from the first. We pick up about a month after the first series left. So just to recap, Family Law is a black comedy about divorce.
Right.
The first series, you know, it's the funniest thing in the world, right? Divorce. Sure. The first season was very much a kind of will they, won't they arc. And the two parents, you know, we kick off by seeing the mum throughout the dad in episode one. And when you're a kid, it's a really confronting thing for your parents to go through. And over the course of a summer holiday in Queensland, there's Ben at the center of things trying to slightly ridiculously repair the family. And so that will they, won't they question hangs over all six episodes until you get to the end. And I think the audience was probably expecting, and sorry for the spoilers if you haven't seen the first series, but they end by coming to the conclusion that some parents work better apart. And it's right. This really optimistic, mature adult realization. That's the end of series one. Series two, what we wanted to do was ask, what separation and divorce has ever gone smoothly, guys? So they're dealing with the repercussions. As I said, we pick it up about probably a month in the story world later. You just have to ignore that the kids have really jumped. You know, puberty happens during summer. That happens very fast. And then we take it off from there. And it's really exploring the aftermath. So if series one was exploring the lead up to divorce, series two is exploring what happens next.
And are we still in autobiographical territory?
We're not making a documentary, we're not making a reenactment, so our whole thing is that it's inspired by true events. But some basic details, like for instance, the show is set in present day, and the kid who, Benjamin, played by Tristan Goh, he is 14 years old. So unless I've somehow bent time and space, I'm not 14 at the moment. I'm more than double that. And so we've taken a lot of liberties, but there are some things central to the show that are true. In series one, that scene where the mum kicks out the dad, that's very similar to what happened in real life. And similarly, in episode one of series two, the way that Danny opens up an Asian grocery store, that's exactly what my dad did after the divorce as well.
Right, wow.
So we're playing with some basic truths and then running with, you know, what drama we can get out of it. Because our whole mantra in the writer's room is what's the emotional truth rather than what really happened.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Considering it's an autobiographical story, did you feel much compulsion when you were younger to be trying to hold the parents together? Like, was it all on your shoulders?
I think all kids weirdly think that they can save their parents' marriage. You know, when you can feel that there's tension, when you feel like there's fighting. And in a way, what happened in the first episode of the first series is that the parents start fighting about something, about one of the kids, and then it spirals into every other horrible hurt that they've ever argued about. And so, of course, if you're a kid witnessing that, you think, my parents had that horrible fight that split them up because of me. And partly that's kind of self-obsession, but it's also a kid's understanding of how the world works, that the world revolves around them. And as a result, I think a lot of kids think, yeah, I can solve this. And I think between me and my four siblings, we at all stages kind of thought, well, if we did this, this can make the situation easier, or this will, you know, dispel the tension in the room. It doesn't ever quite work that way because you're not the adult in the room.
Yeah, I mean, within the show, all of it's pretty much on Benjamin's shoulders.
Yeah.
But if we saw the show from the other kids' perspectives, do you think that would see that? Or do
very
you think,
different yeah. shows, absolutely. And I'm really mindful of that. Like, for instance, my youngest sister, Michelle, who is a character in the show, in real life is also a writer, and she also writes about the family as well. She's got a really different take. So I want to make sure that she has the space to tell her version of a family story from her perspective, which is 8 years younger.
How much, not that they would sign off on it officially, but how much...
Like input, approval do they get?
Approval. Like you'd have to be a little nervous about, yeah. well, I don't want to... Like that's her story maybe?
Totally, totally. Kind of, and I guess like one of the things is I'm not trying to write like an expose. Like I didn't grow up in this haunted house of horror and abuse, you know, like other people might
yeah,
have.
Sure.
And that's they might be writing their story in that spirit. I'm writing the story from a very different way. They're kind of, it sounds awful, I think I've been forced into becoming used to how I write about them because I used to write about them in columns and stuff. But I always check, like I'm about to write about you guys.
Yeah.
This is what it is. How do you feel about it? They might tweak some things as well. Even when I was writing the book, The Family Law, we did that. And I think when we were developing the TV show, when it wasn't greenlit yet, I think everyone was excited and nervous mm-hmm. in various measures. And what changed was when they read the first draft of the script, and then everyone was on board because they were stoked. They thought it was really funny. They thought it was dark as well. And I guess one of the things that all of my family members share, despite being very different people, is a kind of a similar sensibility or sense of humour as well. So they were really on board from then. They reviewed all the scripts. I think they did have to sign off something legally. Like, I don't think they can sue me. Maybe they can sue me. I should probably check that. And then with series two, they're just all on board. They make cameo appearances in both series as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Was there ever a consideration to get Michelle, considering she is a writer, joining the writing team?
She actually was on board. She helped us develop the first series as well. So she was in the writer's room very early on. And then, of course, she's ended up working on her own stuff as well. So she's just had a play at La Boite in Brisbane. She's got a project coming. I'm not sure how much I can tell people about her next project, but she's working on something big at the moment. So she's got her own stuff, and I guess The Family Law is my version of the story.
Your parents also are totally cool and on board?
Yeah. I mean, I'm really lucky. I think there's a stereotype that a lot of Asian parents aren't particularly stoked with their kids getting into any kind of creative arts. And I think that's often true. I look at my cousins and there is that kind of attitude from my aunties and uncles, but my parents weren't like that. And beyond that, I'm lucky that they support me in telling my version of events. My mom, you know, she was a single mom of five kids. It's not like she had that many opportunities to tell her own story when she was going through this stuff. And I think she really loves kind of the way that we've captured her story, because as much as it's Ben's story, the other real central character in all of this is mum, Jenny. And my dad's really zen about it. He's just like, oh, you know, there are people who will see this story. They know it's your story. And if I told the story, it'd be different. You do what you want. He's like really... He's like really chillingly casual about it.
Sounds like someone who's at peace.
I know, yeah. Or someone who's like smoked a few. No, that wouldn't be my dad, not at all.
Now, when you were in production on season two, I did a set visit for a day.
Yeah.
And the thing that stuck out at me was everyone was just obsessed with the Jenny Law character.
Oh, yeah.
And do you really sort of think that she'd be such a breakout character that people would identify so heavily with her?
In real life, she is a big character as well. Jenny, she's probably the only character where people who know her in real life look at the screen version of her and say, no, your mum's more intense. Like, she's far more colourful. She's far more extreme. Like, I tend to tell people that Jenny Pang, as she's known in real life, she is like the R-rated version, and our Jenny Law on the show is like M15+. And... anyone who's met my mum never forgets her. The first series opened with the character of Jenny telling the most graphic story of childbirth at the most appropriate setting possible, which is the 14th birthday of one of her children. And that people are like, oh, that's so over the top. That kind of happened in real life. And it's like, dude, that was my daily life. They meet mum and then they realise, oh, that's who your mother is. And so... I don't think I went into the show with expectations, but I do know that when people meet my mum, when they read about my mum, when they read the weird sex advice column that we co-write together, like she has an answer, then I have an answer, it's really odd, that they always rush to her with love and affection, and they embrace the scandalous nature of her.
Well, the show is a great tribute to her.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a great...
I hope so.
She's a great character, and... I mean, you can sort of see to the extent, to what extent it's based on real life almost. I mean, you would get that some of the things that she says might be a little bit exaggerated, or maybe not, but she's very lovable and funny. It's really nice.
I'm glad you say that because, you know, the last thing that we'd want is people thinking that it's a parody or a stereotype or a piss take or anything like that. And for us in the writer's room, we actually script the entire show like a drama, first and foremost. We know that there's comedy in there. We know that we're writing a comedy. But for us, if it doesn't have those beats of deep heartache, of what it feels like for your kids to turn on you, for you to regret something that you've done with your partner or something like that. If you don't get those real three-dimensional pangs of heartbreak, we're not telling the right story.
Right.
Mm.
Yeah. At some point, Dan has taken off his headphones, I feel, a little bit.
Oh. Okay. You're the only one in the room. You're the only one having protected sex now.
It's a little weird. Yeah, I feel a little uncomfortable.
I felt there's a vibe in the room.
We should point out that Nick's just wearing headphones and nothing else.
But you can't... Yeah, right. You should... I'm glad you pointed that out.
Man likes to feel comfortable. Now, in chatting with both Fiona Choi, who of course plays Jenny Law, and Anthony Brandon Wong, who plays your father, Danny Law, both of them were really rapt to be able to play the opportunity... Mm. Or to have the opportunity to play a character that wasn't the stereotypical, like, fourth-level character on a TV show. So when you go through both their careers, both have had extensive careers in Australia and in Hollywood... But every time, like, Fiona Choi, like, she'll be playing, you know, Scientist Number 3 or just... And, you know, there's an opportunity for them to be leads of a series. Mm. So, from your perspective, if you do more TV work from now on, do you think that you feel an obligation to make sure the actors are being serviced in that way?
I'm not sure I feel the obligation, but I always would want to have some role in... I don't know. Promoting diversity sounds really earnest and cosmetic in a way, but all I really want to do is show... the families that I know, the neighborhoods that I know, the communities that I know. I mean, like, it's funny. When I talk about the family law, often we talk about, you know, putting Asian faces on screen, like it's something we should do. It's like a social justice thing that we should do. But for me, you know, if you look at the stats, 1 in 10 Australians have significant Asian heritage. And the fact that we don't see them on screens, it would be like... if you didn't see black faces on American screen, because proportionately... just over 1 in 10 Americans are African American as well. And when you think of black representation there, and then you think of how much Asian representation we've got here, you're right, they're often the secondary characters, to the point where Anthony and Fiona, for a really long time, they've been professional actors for decades, plural, but they've had to spend significant amounts of time in the United States because there simply isn't enough work for them here. And there is enough work here if you are, you know, a mainstream Anglo actor. So I would think that in future work, look, if I'm writing about families, the families that I know are Chinese Australian. And I guess my friendship circles and my communities and the people, you know, the streets that I walk down are a multitude of ethnicities and cultures as well. I'm not sure how you would disentangle that from writing an Australian story.
Yeah, there was a period, maybe I want to say the 90s, where you'd have shows based in New York and there's no black people in it. Mm, like, this doesn't,
that's weird, right?
Does not look like New York.
And I think if you saw that now, it'd be kind of creepy.
Yeah, it would be terrifying. And same with here. If you're just walking down the street, you're going to see a bunch of different people, different looking people, and it's just normal.
And I think we're reaching that point just now in Australia where if you do spot an all-white cast, whether it's a reality TV show or a drama or a comedy, you do notice now. It's not the start of like a revolution, but I think it's a start in making sure that, you know, TV shows look like Swanston Street in Melbourne or Central Station Tunnel in Sydney or the main way you get to work.
Right. So you end up talking a lot about diversity on these kinds of making the promotional rounds.
Yeah.
And I wonder if you ever, like, if you get tired of it, but that, like, you're the only one talking about it.
Yeah, why? Now Ronnie Chang on the ABC as well. And Lawrence, I mean, I know what you mean because I sometimes feel that, like,
Like, why don't we ask the white people
absolutely.
About diversity and their role in it and everything?
Totally. That would make for a really interesting podcast and interview. I'd totally listen to that as well.
As the only white guy in the room, I'm feeling very uncomfortable right now.
Do you feel targeted? Do you feel triggered and attacked? You're a snowflake.
So we're just getting warmed up. It's going to get worse.
I think it's a really fair question, and I'm glad that you picked up on that, because I'm often in two minds about it, because on one hand, I do feel tired sometimes because you're kind of the only ex in the village.
Yeah.
I think that's changing now with Ronnie Cheng's show on the ABC. We had Maximum Choppage, Lawrence Leung's show on ABC2 as well. You're starting to get Asian main characters as well on screen. But I think because it is still so new, I also still think the discussion is ongoing and it's important to have, because unless someone's having it, you're going to have what we've had throughout the entire history of Australian television, which is silence about it. And I think some people are kind of surprised that we've reached 2017 and it's like, well, we weren't having this conversation before. Why is it a problem now? What I think is different is that these new generations of non-white Australian producers, writers, directors, actors have actually come up into the fray. They're at the centre of things now. I mean, arguably the only reason the Family Law got up is because of our executive producer, Tony Ayres, who happens to be Chinese-Australian.
Right.
He's now one of the most powerful, influential TV makers in Australia. But when he was starting out, he would have been the one having these conversations as well, with no one above him really to support those claims as well. So now I feel I've got these Yoda-like figures, Debbie Lee, our other executive producer, also happens to be Chinese-Australian. You know, we're forming our little mafias. And as those mafias are still kind of nascent, you still need to have that conversation broadly. And it's been nice to see, as I've worked on other television shows in writers' rooms as well, that it's not really a question anymore. It's just like, well, yes, that character is, you know, Sri Lankan, or that character is Indigenous, or that character is queer, or whatever. Like, it's folded into it, and you're not having that conversation anymore. You're talking more about the story, which is nice.
Well, that's heartening. It can sometimes seem like the burden of diversity is on
the diverse people.
And they're the only ones talking about it. And then it makes them seem like...
that they're kind of like pushing an agenda, right? Well, it's like, of course, you'd talk about
the
diversity.
The radical diversity agenda.
Absolutely. So I completely feel that sometimes. And there's, you know, This American Life, very famous podcast. There's a producer and a reporter on it called Stephanie Fu. And she talks about how... you know, so often the discussion and the recruitment of diverse workplaces falls on people of colour, but it always places the onus on them to be the educators or them to be the agents of change, whereas often the people in power are still, you know, non-diverse people, heterosexual people, white people, men as well, able-bodied people as well. And unless they get on board, I mean, minorities are minorities for a reason. They're not the majority, and they're often the people who don't hold the chips and the cards.
Right.
So the conversation has to be extended, unfortunately, by us, and hopefully then you've got other people joining in as well.
Yeah. Just a brief plug. I'd just like to point out, as part of the Family Law website, there's some great pieces that Ben wrote about the amount of Asian comedies that are taking place across the world right now. And there was also another piece regarding the need for greater diversity on Aussie TV.
Yeah. Well, so I wrote that piece about, you know, I guess what would you call it? Like Asian diaspora comedy, which sounds really unfun and unfunny. But when you think about it, like Masters of None on Netflix, which is like a huge success, that would fall into it. Like to have someone like Aziz Ansari being at the center of his show. Like, what I find fascinating about his show is, like, you kind of notice whiteness on the show for the first time. Usually with shows you notice non-white characters.
It's a great experience.
It's a really interesting kind of thing, because sometimes that's my everyday experience as well. But there's, like, a really great web series in New Zealand as well that I think is fantastic. Obviously, people compare our show favourably and happily to Fresh Off the Boat, which is a show that we really love as well. Yeah. Talk about Maximum Choppage.
Both have very strong family connections.
Yeah, really strong family connections. And I think, you know, we're different kinds of comedies, but it's kind of nice because some of the cast members know about our show and we obviously know about them. So, like, we tweet each other and send each other gifts and things. There's a real sense of solidarity.
So you said that we're going in a good direction in terms of diversity on Australian TV. Here Come the Habibs.
Mm-hmm. On Channel 9.
That's coming back.
Yes, second
it's
series.
Back right now.
It's back right now, right?
Yeah.
Is that, do you consider that to be part of the...
I think so, absolutely. Well, how many Lebanese Australians have we seen? I think a lot of people, you know, maybe people who are fans of a certain type of television had a kind of an allergy to Here Come the Habibs, and it's just like, it's really broad stereotypes. And to an extent, that's true. But when I watch the show, I think that a lot of the parodies are of Anglo people as well. It's very broad humour. It's not necessarily what everyone's looking for in a comedy, but it really plays on that. It extends the really grand tradition in Australia of specifically ethnic comedies like Acropolis Now and things like that, Wogs Out of Work. Whereas, like, I think with The Family Law, what's different about our show is that as much as those racial and cultural specifics are in it, that's not the plot of our show. Whereas I think with Here Come the Habibs, it is. And I think that's legitimate too.
Yeah, it's been funny talking to Nick, because the two of us discussed this on a pretty much hourly basis at this stage. where Nick, obviously not being from here, he's really sort of bristling against the very broad nature of what, you know, quote-unquote ethnic comedy in Australia.
Yeah, sure.
And trying to explain to him what Acropolis Now was has really sort of hurt his brain a little bit, I think.
Yeah. I mean, look, I grew up with Acropolis Now, Effie as well, just being that incredible kind of hairsprayed figure. You know, there was more hair than head as well. And I think because you know, that was a very certain place and time as well, the 80s and the 90s, where that was so big. It was in its own way groundbreaking at the time too. I think we look back at those comedies and think they're a little bit dated, which I guess they would be. But, you know, before then, like, there was no way of accessing a broader audience with any representation. And to get them through comedy was to have them on side. And there was great power. You know, you have to remember that WOG was a really brutal pejorative for a really long time. And the Greeks and the Italians were very, very seen as other, you know, really, really othered. To bring people into the laugh track of that, I think, was a really monumental change. But I think now, 2017, you've taken very differently.
Well, so what I was talking to Dan about was Here Come the Habibs seems to follow in that tradition, which not being from here, I'm not familiar with. But it seems dated. It seems like something that might have aired 30 years ago.
Yeah, but I think it's also got its audience and its place as well. You know, like obviously it's gone to second series as well, and it had a huge audience. And, you know, I guess it's about intention as well. Like, what do you want to make out of the show? It's about embracing difference, embracing that the Lebanese neighbours and the white neighbours, at the end of the day, you have more in common than you have different, all that sort of stuff. That I think a lot of people would say, well, I already know that. But I think a lot of people don't as well. And I think that's why, you know, you've still got people being deeply Islamophobic, deeply racist pockets of Australia. For it to reach a mainstream audience, I mean, I'm probably not necessarily the target audience of that show, but I think that it makes a lot of people in the Lebanese Australian community happy. I also know that it rubs a lot of people in the Lebanese Australian community very much the wrong way.
I heard you on a podcast.
Yes.
For the first series. Uh-huh. I think it might have been you and your sister.
Yeah.
And you were talking about diversity on TV. And did the first series of Family Law come out at the same time as Here Come the Habibs?
It did. Basically exactly the same time, I think. So while Habibs was coming out on Channel 9, we were rolled out on SBS. So we were often in the same rooms having that same conversation as well. And Rob Shahidi, one of the co-creators of Habibs, I think has often been put in a position where he has to defend the show very, very strongly. But
and it gets difficult because then it generates a little... If he says something that's not exactly right, then it's more controversial.
Yeah, but the show is what it is. And, it is broad, unapologetically broad. It's going to use ethnicity and race as the basis of its humour as well. I think you can do that and get that right as well. And they've clearly found the formula that the audience really loves.
I mean, I appreciate that people, it resonates with people. Mm. Yeah, like you say, maybe I'm not the audience for it necessarily, but when it comes out at the same time as The Family Law and Ronnie Chang, and you just see kind of the opposite.
It's ethnic month on television.
But the different approaches where The Family Law feels like, well, this is kind of normal and feels like a show that should be happening.
Well, we were really conscious about this. So in the writer's room, there's kind of a danger where we're scripting the first show on Australian television that has an Asian Australian family at its centre, right?
Right.
We acknowledge that that's groundbreaking. But to write, to consciously try to write a groundbreaking show is going to be the death of any goodness or quality or creativity, right? And what we really wanted to do was tell a story, a black comedy about divorce. They happened to be Chinese. We didn't want to erase their Chineseness. In fact, we're going to really zone in on all the specifics. We're going to have the mom and the dad have malapropisms with their English, but that's not going to be the extent of their character as well, right? Because I think that's when they become two-dimensional stereotypes, when they're just a walking cliche or a punchline or whatever. But at the same time, what we really wanted to be aware of was that we weren't just telling a show about race. And I think in some ways we really focused on race in earlier drafts, and then we kind of backed away from it slowly as we got more confident telling the central story of divorce. And one of the first things, well, I think it is the very first thing that Ben says in voiceover in episode one was, you know, for a really long time, I thought my mom was embarrassing and cringeworthy and all of that stuff because she was Chinese. Then I realized it's just mum.
Yes.
So we were really explicitly signaling to the audience, you might think that this is a show about a crazy Chinese mum, but actually it's a mum who happens to be Chinese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think that the big diversity win is when The Family Law is on Channel 7?
That's a really good question. Yeah, maybe.
Just because of the bigger audience and it's mainstream.
I mean, I know what you're talking about. To see the kind of faces that you see.
Not that I'm trying to chase you off the network.
No, not at all. Steal me into the land of commercial networks. I know what you're getting at, because to see the kind of faces that you do in The Family Law on commercial television is rare outside of reality television,
right?
I think reality TV in a strange way has done more.
It's much better for diversity
and multiculturalism in this country than scripted comedy and drama. And we've got a 90% Asian Australian lead cast too. So to see that on a commercial network would be new. But at the same time, there are some sensibilities of our show that make us very public broadcast. And that's got nothing to do with the ethnicity. It's more to do with
sensibility.
You're not going to get a woman talking about how her vagina explodes in the first scene of a Channel 7 comedy, you know?
Right.
So that's why I think, you know, Habib's is the right fit for a commercial entity like Channel 9. It'd be interesting to see if a comedy with you know, non-Anglo faces that isn't about race could make it. I think you're right. Maybe that would be the change. I don't think it's our show. Our show is different for various other reasons.
Right.
But I think another show could do it, and it should.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Now, we've been talking very heavily about race in terms of diversity, but I mean, you do have a show with a teenage boy of whom is gay.
Yeah.
And, like, I think that the odds of seeing a sitcom on Channel 7 is probably more in the favour of an Asian family on there than a sitcom with a teenage gay boy.
And you might be right, actually. It's funny, we've always flagged to the audience from the very start that this is a gay teenager and you're going to be several steps ahead of him. You know, so he's peering through the telescope. He's got every opportunity to peer at the hot female neighbour, and the telescope goes down to the hot male neighbour as well. And he has no vocabulary for it. He doesn't share those feelings with anyone. In fact, he's not really sure what those feelings are. And then we go straight to the next scene. So we are making sure that the audience knows, but we're not making it plot yet because we've got other plot things to deal with. But I think you could be right. Like, to do queer sexuality and, you know, gender variant people on television, I think is quite new. I think we keep talking about the transgender tipping point on television. That's quite new for American TV, and we're always behind the Americans. It'll be a while yet, but I think it's been fascinating seeing something like Please Like Me carve out a space over four series on Australian TV. I think what that show's done, not just for queer identities, but also normalising mental illness and creating discussion around that, is a really important, beautiful thing.
We don't want to take up your whole day.
No, you're allowed to if you want.
Okay, well then.
We've got all our clothes off already.
Now to politics. So we're a TV and movies podcast.
Uh-huh.
And to wrap up, we like to ask our guests what they've been watching. TV, movies, anything you love, hate.
Okay, so Veep is always comfort watching in our house.
Great.
It's just so savage and brutal. And
great.
I feel like it's getting even more fucked up in the insults as well. It's like... you know, just when you think it can't shock you anymore, it just takes it to a new level of horror. And I feel like the relationship between Selena and Gary is even more abusive this current series as well. So we just, I just know that when there's a new episode up that I'm going to have a really fun night. So I love that. I'm kind of between big dramas, though, at the moment, because what did we come off watching recently that we really liked? We really liked Legion. This is me and my partner. We really liked Legion on FX because my boyfriend's like a, he was a huge X-Men fan as a kid, and I really liked X-Men as well. But this is like a really strange hallucinatory take on it. We started watching Twin Peaks, the sequel. It's not a reboot. It, you know, it's a sequel that takes place 25 years later or whatever. And that is fascinating and batshit. You know, like the original was always a combination like of dramatic tension and batshit insanity. And I feel like it's all four have been 100% batshit. So I'm still getting my head around it, but I'm enjoying it. I feel invested.
You were a big fan of the original?
I really love the original. I watched it when I was way too young. I watched it when I was like 8 or 9. That's what happens when you have older siblings. it's just like, yeah, Bob, what a friendly character to see on screen. And what
it's
else?
It's strange when Legion isn't the strangest thing on TV that year.
I know.
Because that's a pretty strange show.
It is nuts, right? Yeah. It's really, really bizarre. But like, oh, Aubrey Plaza, she's so good in it. what else have we been really
Do you go to movies?
Liking? Yeah, we go to the movies. What did I just see? I was just spectacularly disappointed with Alien Covenant. I really liked Ali's Wedding, which is on at the Sydney Film Festival at the moment.
That's
the first Muslim rom-com to come out of Australia. And it's gorgeous. It's really, really gorgeous. What else have I been seeing at the
moment? Is that a good antidote for those that aren't quite into the Habibs?
Yeah. It's a very different tone. And Ali's Wedding is made by the same production company that makes The Family Law. So, Matchbox Pictures. So, Tony Ayres, who kind of brought my book to the screen, he's also brought Osama Sami's book and made it into Ali's Wedding with some really excellent producers as well. So, really, really gorgeous Australian story if you can see it. I think it's out in August in general release.
Mm. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ben. It's been great.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
So that was Benjamin Law speaking to Nick and producer Dan. Nice job, guys.
Super nice, dude.
And you can catch Family Law Series 2 is airing on SBS Australia at 8:30 on Wednesdays. And you can catch up on the series at SBS On Demand.
So Benjamin Law is clearly a TV fan. Mm. What have you been watching?
Well, I caught a very 80s movie. Perfect. John Travolta, Jamie Lee Curtis, set in the gyms of Los Angeles in the 80s. Yeah, aerobics. She's an aerobics instructor in the whole leotard. And he's a Rolling Stone reporter doing an investigative piece about our gyms, the singles bars of the 80s. And, yeah, it's exactly what you think it's going to be. Music, very synthy, lots of star jumps. And, yeah, it's fun. It ain't great, but...
Is there any dancing in it?
Well, aerobics.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
But is John Travolta doing aerobics?
No. Well, he does a scene, but Jamie's the star of the show doing the aerobics in that one.
I'm picturing Xanadu. Is John Travolta in that?
No, Olivia Newton-John is in that.
Right. What? Why were you watching that?
bought it, actually, very cheap at a charity shop. I do a lot of op shopping. And
you're going to turn that around on your website? Is that the plan?
It's resale value. We'll skyrocket after this conversation, that's for sure. Mm. You know, never seen it. Picked it up. Now I have seen it.
Wow.
Yeah. Welcome to my getting That's a little fantastic. Glimpse at my inner life. And what about you? What have you been watching?
Well, I've talked on this show before about my love of sad, angry, depressing 50s movies.
Yeah.
And so the other day I watched The Hustler,
Ooh.
Which is not a 50s movie.
No,
it's 61. But it sits very well in that area where Paul Newman is a young pool player who is a little bit headstrong and he needs to learn how to not get ahead of himself and be in it for the long haul. And he comes up against a fantastic pool player, an older, more experienced one, and Jackie Gleason, Minnesota Fats. It's just so great watching Paul Newman torn apart inside in his tight white t-shirt doing his that Marlon Brando 50s era deal. I love all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And George C. Scott is really great in it, really nasty. And the ending is so good, and it's black and white and stark. It's like A Streetcar Named Desire, but with Paul Newman.
And pool cues.
Yeah.
And famously picked up again in The Color of Money.
Yes.
With your man Tom Cruise.
That's right.
Mm.
Which I have been meaning to rewatch since I watched The Hustler. I really want to watch that again. I don't know if it holds up. If it ever, was it good?
Sure. That's it for now. We'll put some notes about the episode online with recommended links to the shows and the movies we've been talking about. And make sure you subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from and give us a review as well. And if you have any questions for us, get in touch with SBS Movies on Facebook or Twitter. Or you can send us an email at film@sbs.com.au. I'm Fiona Williams. I'm on Twitter as @anythingbutfifi.
I'm Nick Bassine. I'm @Nick, just one, at as far as I know.
That's Nick the Bassine. Naming convention.
Yeah.
And our producer is Dan Barrett. Thanks for listening.